You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. In today's program, we're going to be looking at the history of fundraising because the next couple of shows are concerned with raising money for our illustrious station, CJSF FM 90.1. And so I thought it would be really interesting to look at the past of fundraising and also looking at the future of fundraising, how it's going to change with the advent of new technologies. So for this, I'm using an article written by Megan Donahue entitled 120 Years of Fundraising History, What Can We Learn? Since there have been good causes to support, there has always been fundraising. Communities have rallied to meet needs around the globe and throughout history. In the last 100 years or so, and the how of fundraising has changed dramatically at the same time. The ways we raise and give money constantly change due to new situation, changing needs, evolving priorities, and dramatically evolving technologies. So let's go on a little journey through time and see how fundraising has changed in the past century and see what we can learn about fundraising today and from fundraising history. Whether it's been dollars or gold doubloons, people have always given to causes that they care about, regardless of the surrounding culture, the civilization, or the time in history. Going way back, fundraising before 1900. If you wanted to write a doctoral thesis on pre-1900 fundraising, you will have to have plenty of fascinating material. But we're going to take a wild guess that you don't actually want to read that thesis right now. So for the sake of brevity, we'll skip the deep dive into academics and instead provide our listeners with some quick historical fundraising facts to wow your peers at your next cocktail party. Some quick fundraising history facts. Charitable giving is featured in the holy texts and practices of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, among many other religions. The Song Dynasty ran soup kitchens in China as early as the 10th century. In 1552, Roxelana, wife of the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, opened a charitable complex in Jerusalem to aid widows, orphans, and the poor. The Zulu tribe's tradition of giving in which givers and receivers were considered to be equals was established as early as the 17th century. The word philanthropy came into the English language in 1600. In 1601, the Statute of Charitable Usurers is passed in England, putting the responsibility to care for the poor onto local parishes. The revolutionary thing about this practice is that the implementation of what we would now call programs was done in the private sector, but overseen by government. Benevolent societies and charitable endeavors like schools, relief, refugee relief, orphanages, and hospitals popped up all over the world in the 18th and 19th centuries. The Salvation Army ran their first Christmas Kettle Street campaign in 1891. Pioneers of modern fundraising, the years 1900 to 1915. So, we've established that the charitable principles that drive giving have remained consistent across history. By 1900, communities and people gave to help others in need, make changes, and build new things for centuries. However, the way they raised funds to support these services changed dramatically around this time. So we can ask, how did modern fundraising come to be? Let's take a look at fundraising history. Believe it or not, it all started with the YMCA. The fundraising efforts of two early 20th century pioneers at the Young Men's Christian Association defined the tools and techniques that were used in modern fundraising for the rest of the 20th century and into the 21st century. Here is the short version of that story. A gentleman by the name of Frank L. Pierce was tasked with raising money to build a YMCA in Washington, D.C. In 2 years of campaigning, he managed to raise $270,000, but still needed an additional $80,000, and the donations had stopped coming in. Let's take a moment to empathize with Mr. Pierce. We've all been there at the tail end of a campaign, watching tumbleweeds drift by instead of checks coming in. It's not fun at all. Fortunately, Mr. Pierce was about to get a partner who would help him raise the money and invent the modern fundraising method in the process. In 1905, Mr. Pierce partnered with Charles Sumner Ward. The two men created a campaign to raise the rest of the money, trying things that no one else had ever done before. The top three innovations of the YMCA School of Fundraising. Misters Pierce and Ward engaged a publicist for their campaign and used corporate donations to pay for advertising. They purposely kept their campaign short, capping it at 27 days. They created a campaign clock to measure the time passing and to give a sense of urgency to the fundraising campaign. It all worked very well. Misters Pierce and Ward raised the money, namely $80,000, And by 1913, they were working internationally, running a multi-million dollar campaigns using the techniques they'd just developed. At about the same time, Bishop William Lawrence, the pastor of St. John's Memorial Church at Harvard and the head of the Alumni Association, was asked to raise $2.5 million to increase the liberal arts professors' salaries. Raising money for salaries was new for college fundraising. Historically, alumni had given to capital campaigns. But would they give without the promise of a new building or campus improvement? It was up to Bishop Lawrence to find out. The bishop raised the money mostly by appealing to alumni in a genteel manner via a polite letter asking for their help. The alumni came through, and Bishop Lawrence is credited with creating the college endowment building drive. Bishop Lawrence's approach was deeply respectful of his audience, and he kept things low-key on purpose. He's known to have said, quote, "If you dominate or dragoon a man by your personality, you may get his money once, but not the next time," he was quoted in saying. And so Bishop Lawrence's successful approach has been solidified into our fundraising history. Early 20th century takeaways. The techniques established by Messrs. Pierce, Ward, and Bishop Lawrence are still in use today, whether or not we know to credit them. In fact, they're all over CauseVox, and you're probably already using them year after year. Fundraising during the World Wars. Getting organized. Civilian fundraising was a big part of life on the home front during both World Wars. Fundraising professionals and private citizens joined together to raise money to support the military, hospitals, and the Red Cross. Many small local charities merged during World War I, that went from 1914 to 1918, to increase their effectiveness, and many chose to remain big and national after the war was over. During the Great Depression, going from 1929 to 1939, people remained charitable, even when their resources were limited. Changes in the tax law made corporate donations possible to an extent, and they became a bigger part of the fundraising pie. Fundraising also shifted to include appeals to lower and middle class donors, rather than only seeking gifts from the wealthy. World War II, extending from 1939 to 1945, brought a return to war-focused fundraising and a concentration on a cause. People came together to support the troops and try to solve the social issues caused by war, famine, and refugee resettlement. Fundraising takeaways. First of all, major gifts are great, but don't forget the average donor. Small gifts can make a big difference, especially when there's a lot of them. Secondly, corporate partners can give you a lift, even when the economy isn't so good. The post-war era. Enter the TV, 1949 to 1970. It's really hard to express the extent to which television changed the world. From what we buy, to how we talk, and many other areas of culture, television has shaped our culture in a myriad of ways by bringing images, messages, and people directly into our homes. But it is no surprise that television changed fundraising history. The first telethon was in 1949. Telethons may seem old-fashioned now, but this was cutting-edge technology in 1949. Before World War II, there were approximately 7,000 home TVs in America. In 1950, only 9% of American homes had a TV set. However, by 1960, that percentage was dramatically higher at 87%. The structure of telethons was established early on and did not change drastically for many, many years. It featured a long block of airtime, the thon in the telethon, as in marathon, hosted by a celebrity. The show alternated between entertainment and appeals for pledges to benefit a charity. I myself can remember the Jerry Lewis telethon to raise money for his favorite charity, which I seem to remember was for MS or some similar disease. Telethons changed fundraising by offering a broader platform than a charity could reach on its own. In the days before cable, with limited channels, if someone was going to watch TV, there was a pretty good chance that they would encounter your telethon. In addition to raising money, this method also raised awareness of the causes. The most famous of the telethons began in New York City in 1966 with, as I mentioned before, the Muscular Dystrophy Association's Labor Day telethon hosted by Jerry Lewis. The 21-hour event raised more than $1 million out of the gate, prompting Lewis to paint an extra digit on the pledge counter display. In 1968, the telethon was shown on four additional stations in New York and Massachusetts. WHEC-TV chose to cut away from the program to show local volunteers taking calls, and another standard feature of telethons, the local segment, was born. By 1970, the MDA telethon was broadcast coast to coast. It ran nationally, hosted by Lewis, until 2010, and then underwent a change in format, shorter and more appealing to modern audiences. Don't Change the Channel, Fundraising Commercials, 1980 to 2000. Telethons weren't the only fundraising happening on TV. Taking a page out of the Misters Ward and Pierce YMCA book, nonprofits started advertising campaigns on TV, a practice that continues to this day. Television advertising is expensive, but in the early 1980s, nonprofits took advantage of the less-in-demand time slots, late night, early morning, for example, and the lower rates available on the new cable TV. Advertising on TV allowed nonprofits to tell stories quickly. It used all the tools of commercial advertising to demonstrate the impact of organizations, including evocative music, intense or even disturbing images, and hard sell pleas for donations from celebrity spokespeople. Commercials weren't cost effective for every organization, but when they paid off, they really paid off big. Sally Struthers became a celebrity spokesperson for the Christian Children's Fund in 1976, and is credited with bringing the organization millions of dollars. Her work, first for the CCF and later for the Save the Children, became iconic. Television advertising is not without controversy. The emotional and dramatic storytelling style some charity ads crossed the line into exploiting the populations it sought to serve, portraying people in the developing world as helpless victims with little regard for their dignity. However, this style of ad soon fell into disfavor, and organizations generally moved in a more positive direction with their imagery and fundraising pitches in the 1990s. In the 21st century, TV advertising continues to be effective for some organizations. For example, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals raised $30 million in the first 3 years of running their ad featuring singer Sarah McLachlan. As she said, "I will give these puppies anything they want as soon as they stop crying." It really pulled at your heartstrings. During the latter half of the 20th century, nonprofits didn't use TV, of course. They continued to use direct mail letters and in-person fundraising events. But a new game changer, even bigger than TV, was quietly developing: digital fundraising. Lessons from the late 20th century. First of all, emotional and visual storytelling works. Secondly, it is possible to go too far. Respect the populations you serve. Online fundraising, the years 2000 to the present. The internet. In 1997, 18% of American households reported accessing the internet. By 2003, more households than not, 54.7%, had internet access. This upward trend continued in the following years. Like television before it, the technological advance of computers and internet would radically change society within a decade. Nonprofits began to adapt to this change. At first, they used the internet much as they had print and direct mail websites, providing static information about organizations and their causes, like a brochure, and email emerged as a lower cost way to distribute appeals and newsletters. As people became more comfortable paying for things online, for example, PayPal was founded in 1998, which eventually launched the career of Elon Musk. Online donations became much more common. Social media. In the early years of the 21st century, the internet became even more interactive. Facebook was founded in 2004 and allowed nonprofits to start pages in April of 2006. At this time, nonprofits began to use social media to build relationships, share content, and fundraise. Artists, musicians, and entrepreneurs started using the internet to raise money for their projects in the late 1990s, and crowdfunding hit the mainstream in the early 2000s. Once again, technology was new, but the message was classic. If everyone pitches in, we can make something new. Social media provided an easy way for people to share projects with their entire social network at once. Soon, platforms designed to raise money became commonplace, and nonprofits began experimenting with various forms of crowdfunding. Mobile apps. In 2007, Apple introduced the first iPhone, and Google's Android followed in 2008. These smartphones were not the first mobile phones to connect to the internet, but they ushered a new era of usability and connectivity. Suddenly, it was possible to donate to a charity online from anywhere, not just from your home computer. Nonprofits and crowdfunding had begun to adapt again to giving possibly through smartphones and text messages. So why does fundraising history matter? At this point, you might be thinking, neat, I know when the first telethon happened, but how does that impact my fundraising now? Fundraising is diverse. When something works, we keep it until it doesn't. Sometimes we keep it after it doesn't, but that's something we need to work on in the nonprofit sector. The Salvation Army is raising funds online and puts red kettles on street corners, much as they did in the 1890s, to the tune of almost $150 million in 2016. Most organizations send fundraising letters, like Bishop Lawrence, and post on Facebook. You might find something in history that works for you now. More importantly, it's vital to see what is universal in fundraising. Whenever we experience a big technological shift, we can feel intimidating. It's like your whole job changed right underneath you. But the thing that unites fundraisers from 1900 until now is connecting communities to causes. So, people love to give because of storytelling, because of relationships, because they want to make a difference, and because they care about people. As a profession, fundraising is quite young, but we've made tremendous progress in organization, professionalism, and technology in the last 120 years of fundraising history. As we move forward, there's no doubt that we'll make new discoveries, try new techniques, and develop new technologies. The top fundraising techniques today are bound to become fundraising history. Still, the more things change, the more some good things will stay the same. What will stay the same will be people, caring, and their generosity. So, in connection with today's theme of the history and the future of fundraising, I would like to extend my wish for my listening audience to give generously to support CJSS programming, to keep these shows and all the other shows online, and to continue producing quality programming as we have for the last many, many decades. And in order to encourage people to give generously to the station, I would like to offer the following aid, is that for every $100 donated to CJSF, I will donate to that person a copy of one of my books. For example, my book on the future trends in 3D printing, which I published numerous years ago, which looks at the long-term trends of 3D printing and how they're going to impact the individual and society. And for women who are concerned about health, I'm willing to offer a free copy of my book, which talks about how to the exercises you can do to reduce your risk of breast cancer. It's called Lymph Mobbed and Booby Trapped, which talks about how modern fashion options can often lead to bad health outcomes for women, and also for some men as well, and how to overcome these limitations and these health problems. And so please go to the station in the new student union building, CJSF offices, and give a donation, and leave your email with the station. My email, if you want to contact me directly, is tinarip@yahoo.com, spelt Tinari, T-I-N-A-R-I-P, at yahoo.com. Send me your email, and you can do an e-transfer to me, and then I will forward it to the station, and I will forward to you a copy of one of my books on 3D printing or on lymphatic health and reducing your risk of breast cancer. So I'm looking forward to your generous donations to the station, and I will continue with my programming next week. So I wish you a great week and a great fall season.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Tinari, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.